Gertos, the 28th day of Genbon, year 17 of Ramak IV. My convalescence of recovery was entirely abandoned when my assistant Dakon told me of the activities of our conscripted workers, and I had guessed what he didn't plainly say. The workers were excavating through the wall that held frescoes of the ancient Taid Empire painted upon it. They had already destroyed the carvings depicting the Taid gods on the opposite wall, and now their senseless work was destroying the other remnant of the classic culture that we had found. I scrambled from my encampment site and ran with all speed into the Calderian structure. The complicated footprint of its architecture was all too familiar to me, as I had spent the better part of 2 months scouring its halls and corners and cataloging every nuance of art and culture that it held. I wound my way through the labyrinth and down the stairways which led to the scriptorium in the cellar. From there I sought the opening to the passageway that led to the Taid site buried under the Calderian building. I could hear the pickaxes ringing against the stone, issuing from the darkness of the chamber that lay before me. Were the conscripts working in total darkness? My lantern flared out into the Taid chamber, and first it caught the opposite wall, where I could tell they had completed the destruction of all the figures carved there. New scars appeared upon that wall, stonework hacked out, and no figure remained complete upon the scene. At the floor beneath rose a larger pile of rubble, the remnants of the carvings above heaped like a plague cart of lifeless body remnants. The thought flashed across my mind that they had made final attempts, after my admonitions to them, to remove the carvings with more delicacy in order to preserve the face and form of the subjects depicted there. But this fanciful imagining was all dashed to pieces when I swung the lantern light to the opposite wall. Thereupon, the depiction of the Taid festival, done in beauteous artwork and astonishing skill, for the recreation of the figures and the setting, every single face of the god portrayed upon that scene had been scraped off. This was no attempt at removal for posterity's sake. This was desecration, pure and simple. I stood, stunned and slack-jawed, at the thoroughness with which all of the deities depicted on the wall had been defaced. I shook my head in disbelief of the purposeful destruction of the figures depicted there. Why these figures? Up above, in the Calderian building, there were statues of emperors, faded paintings of generals, busts of prominent politicians, all of which were left untouched and unscathed. Why did these Taid figures, then, suffer the full destructions and defacing that was so purposeful, and with some obvious motivational intent? I shook myself out of my wonderment when the ringing of the pickaxes and shovels pierced my cognizance. They were working feverishly and with all abandon, and even with a disregard of my sudden presence and the light of my lantern. I shouted at the conscripts, ordering them to stop, but they kept at their sweaty work with all zeal. Dakon caught up with me and had brought with him, ever mindful of this recent mutiny we were facing, digging tools with which we could arm ourselves. I had previously no notion of the potential danger, but when I gripped the shovel Dakon proffered to me, I fully understood the implications that Dakon was presenting. Both of us then began shouting and calling for the conscripts to desist immediately their wayward endeavor, but they paid us no mind and continued their digging. They were a fair way into the wall already, and one came out with a wooden bucket of debris and dumped it onto an established pile of rubble. Dakon seized his arm in an attempt to restrain him, but the conscript lashed out with his bucket and a violent scuffle ensued. Dakon, in his zeal and fever, struck the conscript with the flat of his spade, and the worker fell immediately to the ground. This brought out the other laborers, and a general melee ensued. I attempted to separate the parties and restore some semblance of order, but a solid blow to my head from a metal digging tool brought my awareness to an abrupt end. All senses ceased immediately. Month of Genmon, year 17, Ramak IV. Same day, same night? I have no way of knowing for certain. I awoke to blackness in the chamber. The lantern had burned out its fuel, and so it was at least a good number of hours since the confrontation with the workers. My senses slowly returned to me, the echoing of my labored and painful movements reaching my ears, the feel of the tiled floor upon which I lay, the smell of the stale air of the ancient chamber. After a moderate amount of time lying in the darkness, I could discern through sight a vague perception of the walls which oriented me to my position in the room. On my head, still rattled with the blow I had taken, I could feel the sticky blood which was caked into my hair, and also gave me an instinctive, though unspecified, clue as to the time that had passed while unconscious. There was no sign of the conscripts, or of Dacon for that matter. I stumbled toward the corner of the chamber, and I could feel a chill air lightly wafting into it. My fingers touched the wall, and as I felt around, I could discern that it provided only a thin barrier to the natural passage beyond. As I groped about in the dark, I stumbled upon a body, which at first I assumed to be Dacon, but upon further investigation, I found it to be one of the conscripts. Of course, as I replayed the memory of the riot that ensued, Dacon had struck one of the working crew before being overwhelmed himself. And this was that worker. My hands groped clumsily over the inert body when my fingers closed around something strange. It was a stone amulet of some kind, hung about the neck by a leather thong. It seemed to be a common thing worn by these workers. I yanked on the stone and the leather broke, and by touch I could discern a carving upon it. Not words or runes or symbols, but a figure with features scored upon it. Though my expertise told me the carving upon the rock was worn with age, and a wear betrayed many, many years past the age of its previous bearer. I squinted at the adornment and could barely discern its shape and figure within a very faint purple glow. I blinked and looked up, and from my vantage I could see the glow emanating from the mouth of the newly discovered tunnel. I was greatly feared to remember that the remaining conscripts were still at large, and they might hold violent intent upon me should my presence be betrayed, but this did not finally deter me. I continued down the tunnel, though upon later reflection I should have gone in the opposite direction and fled the chamber entirely. But in that moment there was only one way open to me, and that was forward into the unknown which lay beyond me. I thus crept slowly down the unfamiliar tunnel, faint purple glow illuminating rough protrusions but obscuring recesses even more. It at once gave me relief to see the shapes of jutting rock outcroppings, while at the same time unnerved me with the impenetrably dark alcoves it created. I found myself traversing a rough-hewn staircase with a low-ceilinged tunnel that led inexorably down to what would reveal itself as a large subterranean cavern. The walls were all natural, the stairway being the only worked stone of the cavern. I could now see the source of the purple light, as there were patches of lichen or fungus scattered about all the surfaces up and down in the area, which emitted a soft glow, which was diffused unevenly about the area. By this illumination, I was able to discern the size of the cavern, which was fairly vast, with a high ceiling and with no immediately detectable exits. Off-center, about the far side of the cavern, was what at first I took to be a sinkhole, as its concave contour gave it a wide, dark opening like a huge hole, or, when fancy took the better of me, a gaping mouth. It being the dominant feature of the cavern, I instinctively moved toward it, though my mind screamed at me to desist my investigation. As I moved out into the cavern proper, my boots landed upon the spongy stuff which emitted the purple glow, and for a short burst upon my footfalls, it flared brighter, but then fell back into its hazy diffusion again after a short moment. The spongy surface betrayed no sound upon my step, and so I worked noiselessly across the cavern, but with brief purple flares upon my passage. What I first imagined to be a deep and dark hole revealed itself to be, at my utmost surprise, not a cavity, but instead the depression was filled with water. It was black in appearance, where even its surface would not reflect the purple glow, and it was rank in smell, as if it had been stagnant for centuries, and rotting, perhaps, over eons of time. As I grew closer to the pool, its smell became more intense and nauseous, and I had to stifle my own retch more than once while in its proximity. And though the air in the cavern was still and unmoving, I thought I had vaguely beheld a slight rippling upon the surface of the pool. Though this was not regular undulations, like water lapping upon its shore on a lake, it was irregular, and still there was no sound within the cave save for my own ragged breathing. My fascination with the pool became distracted when I noted that it was, for its most parts, surrounded by the purplish fungus upon which I stood, save for a clear swath about as wide as a man's leg is long. Though this swath was clear of the fungus on the floor, it was wet with water and a sort of slime which dripped like goo off the regular floor covering along its edges. But what caught my eye was that the swath also had a darkened mixture swirling along its length, and against all instinct I reached down and put my finger into it, and when I brought it to my face to inspect, I could smell the unmistakable odor of iron. For correlation, I reached up into my own head wound and the sticky blood which had coated my hair, and when I compared the two within the purple light, both were dark from the purple light, and both had the same iron smell. The bare swath then was also rivered with blood. I followed the bare path as it led toward a darkened corner of the cavern, and as I descended its general gradual slope, I could make out ahead of me two great pillars carved out of the rock wall. The pillars were decorative, and they were in a crude style which predated even the Taiid Empire by several centuries. The pillars were on either side of a cave mouth yawning between them, but I took no immediate notice of that, for my eyes were caught upon the leftmost pillar, which, as best as I could see in the dim haze of violet, there hung a man-shaped figure. It was easy to discern it as human figure, as its arms were suspended above its head, giving it a distinctively human silhouette. When I approached closer, I could make out details of its face, and immediately I could recognize two things. Its visage revealed itself to be my assistant Dakon. The other feature that was apparent was his face was frozen in a cry of agony and pain. My nose was assaulted as I drew slowly near, and upon inspection I could tell in the dark, dim haze that his entrails had been drawn out from his body, and they were strewn out along the path of the bare rock. His raised arms had been secured into the pillar by metal chisels driven through his wrists. I scanned about the scene, taking it all in, and the nausea I felt at the pool revisited me, and this time I did not resist it. Upon my recovery, I viewed the scene again and noted that the pillars had carved upon them primordial shapes and symbols, many with spiral and star designs as one might view of the prehistorical standing stones of Storlavagard and even the Akko Gap region of the Vuori Mountains. Strangely featured was a totem figure that looked like something familiar, and I reached back in my mind to identify it, but its familiarity escaped me. I pressed on between the two pillars and to the passage beyond. The last thing I could see by virtue of the purple glow was a natural staircase made of flowstone which wound down into an unknown abyss. I moved more from compulsion rather than conviction, and I found myself led down the strange stairway by a familiarity that I could not identify. The purple illumination was now entirely gone. But I could discern details of my surroundings, even though I could not see my own hand waved in front of my face. I continued down the descending passage, hunched down and running my hand along the low ceiling, to avoid hitting my head against any low-hanging outcrops of rock. Down and down I continued, losing all sense of direction and time. I knew not which way I was going or had gone, and I had no idea of 1 minute or hour from the next. At the completion of an impossibly long sojourn, my awareness beheld a vast cavern, so high I could not perceive a ceiling. I ventured out into this cavern, though I still had to stoop my head and run my hand along the rocky canopy. At the time, I did not think this odd. What I could see with my eyes and what I could feel, hear, and touch were at odds with each other, but it was not strange to my mind, except only now as I attempt to recall it. For my eyes beheld a desolate plain in dim white light, and before me, at an impossible angle to itself, was a ziggurat, with stairway ramps on multiple sides, each going to a higher step level of the construction. One endless ramp, which began at my feet, always at my feet, no matter if I stepped forward or back, traversed the entirety of the pyramid to its topmost level, where stood, offset by multitudinous columns, a deep and black sphere. Like the tunnel opening into the Taid chamber, it vented a cold, haunting air. And like the putrid pool of the violet-hazed chamber, it rippled within the absolute stillness and gave off a smell of death and rotting desiccation. And like the tunnel beyond the pillars, it seemed endless and impossibly long, stretching out over infinity, winding endlessly at nonsensical directions. As I was drawn into this blackened abyss, for I was inexplicably now at the zenith of the ziggurat, having traversed the infinite staircase without regard to time or awareness, I fell into its vortex, and weightless I plummeted into its maw, and time and place and being fled from my accounting. I had no feeling, and yet my senses all about me felt the palpability of a soft coldness, the chill of the empty abyss as it enveloped me, swallowed me. And when I had traveled through the ages and past the memory of humans, through an eternity of nothingness, I then abruptly found myself once again in a familiar place. With familiar sight, referencing shapes which were familiar to me. Dakon stood over me, as he had in so many wakings of my convalescence. He looked all familiar to me, and at first I had thought nothing of his visage, which was the last I had seen of him, his face frozen in a primal scream of pain, and his entrails spilled out before him, leading out into a path towards the putrid waters surrounded by purple fog. Then a cacophony of shouts assailed my ears as the melee replayed before me again, of the conscript zealots breaking into a chaos of violence. And as the inescapable blow came to my head once again, I found myself now howling in agony and grief amid the rubble of the destroyed Taid god figures, my soul shredded with pain. And as my eyes went red at my sorrowful shrieks, I was struck into a dreamy awareness of a great shaking and rumbling all about me. Like a drunkard, I stumbled my way through the Taid chamber and to its egress. My great familiarity with the Calderian site did me well to navigate the labyrinth of its halls and rooms, half blinded with half senses afforded me. I stumbled about the structure of archways and concrete as it veritably cracked with loud pops and a terrific fracturing. I could feel the integrity of its strength crumble away and lose its will to remain coherent. I tumbled free of the young building, for young it now seemed since my infinite journey, and it fell in upon itself, all the space and area it encompassed, now a vacuum upon which the stone fell into itself with a great shattering of the air around it. After its initial roar, like a giant thunderclap, all was strangely silent. Hardly a settling of debris could be heard, all the rubble drawn inexorably in upon itself, sealing its mysteries beneath, and only dust hung in the air to attest to the great implosion that had occurred. I took stock of my condition, with only mild scrapes and abrasions as a consequence of my wild and inexplicable journey. In a short moment, I noticed my hand still squeezing as it had been for beyond my recollection. I had to make a conscious effort to release my grip and relax my fingers from their shaky death grip. Upon its opening, my hand revealed the stone figurine I had removed from the dead conscript's neck. The figure I now recognized as I had previously attempted to recall it, as being inscribed upon the pillars to which Dakon had been bound to in such a violent manner. But that is not the image that eluded my memory, the one I could only vaguely recall where I had seen it before. I had seen this image upon his lordship's personal banner. I had not thought upon it before and thought it to be some fanciful design figure, but this same figure was in the hall where he consigned me to this endeavor. This same image in the hall where I had received the conscript recruits for the expedition. This same image in the same hall where he had given the directive for me to accept his son as an assistant to accompany me. This same image upon the pillar where the zealots had sacrificed his son to gain entry into the weird, eternally long tunnel, and the ziggurat of the Chamber of Impossible Dimensions. This same image that the conscripts each wore around their necks, its features worn over centuries, and now, as the full realization came to me, also worn around his lordship's neck as well. I found my makeshift campsite and gathered together supplies I would need to get out of these mountains. I tied tight my traveling bag and, with firm resolve, headed into the opposite direction from his lordship's hall and manor, and into the direction of lands unknown. You've been listening to Excavation of Horror Part 2, a side quest short story of the Dungeons & Damsels series by Unchained Productions, written and directed by David Ian. Voice talent by David Ian. Sound engineering by Dino D. Elfweld. Sound design by David Ian. Theme by Ron Perovich. Music by Mark Rose. Excavation of Horror is a side quest short story of the Dungeons & Damsels series by Unchained Productions.